Two of the writers profiled in a book about the new journalism of the 60s and 70s are back on the bestseller list. The success of the film Capote turned Truman Capote's 1966 book In Cold Blood back into a bestseller. Joan Didion's best-selling memoir, The Year of Magical Thinking, won a 2005 National Book Award. My guest, Mark Weingarten, is the author of the new book, The Gang That Wouldn't Write Straight, Wolfe, Thompson, Didion, and the New Journalism Revolution. Weingarten describes the writers he focuses on as journalists who began thinking like novelists, not in the sense of fictionalizing their reporting, but in developing a novelist sense of character and drama. I ask Weingarten where he thinks Truman Capote's In Cold Blood fits into the new journalism.
I see it as an absolute seismic shock in the way that people approach nonfiction writing. Capote was so meticulous in researching this story of the murder of the Clutter families in Kansas, spending 6 years delving into the murders, the minds of the two murderers themselves, the family, the town in which the murders took place, etc. He also, frankly, took a lot of creative license in his work, using interior monologues and sort of delving into the heads of his characters, which was criticized by his editor at The New Yorker, William Shawn, who was really ambivalent about even publishing the piece because he felt that it was too fabulous, that Capote had really tinkered too much with nonfiction. But in my opinion, it's an absolute masterpiece and sort of a precursor to a lot of the procedural fiction that we read now. But I just think it's a brilliantly written book. And a lot of these writers read that book and absorbed that book and learned a lot of lessons from it.
It was interesting. You say that William Shawn, the editor at The New Yorker when In Cold Blood was published, had serious reservations about even publishing it. In the movie Capote, William Shawn is portrayed as saying to Truman Capote, I'm going to make you a star. And Shawn travels with Capote and answers Capote's phone in the hotel room when Capote's not feeling up to it himself. Is that a misportrayal?
Correct. I love that film, but that was the one thing I took issue with, because having talked to Lillian Ross about this issue, Lillian Ross being a longtime staff writer at the New Yorker, as well as William Shawn's lover for many years, she told me that, yes, Shawn really didn't like the piece. He was very uncomfortable with Capote taking so much creative license. I mean, The New Yorker was such a stickler for facts, with one of the most buttoned-down fact-checking departments. And Shawn just thought that it wasn't appropriate for the magazine. So there was a struggle there before it was published. And in the film, yes, Shawn is really portrayed as a champion of the piece, but to my understanding, that wasn't the case.
You talk about how when Truman Capote first went to Kansas to research the murder story that In Cold Blood is about, he really stood out. What stood out about him?
He was gay. I mean, that's the short answer. Here was this gay Southerner turned New Yorker, very flamboyant, I think even more flamboyantly dressed than he's portrayed by Philip Seymour Hoffman in the film, with that voice and that manner. And people were really turned off by him. People didn't really know who he was, even though he had already published Breakfast at Tiffany's and other books. And it took Capote's skill as an interviewer, as well as his companion, Harper Lee, who helped him out tremendously in opening up many doors to him.
Yeah, Harper Lee, his friend, is best known for writing To Kill a Mockingbird. Exactly what did she do to help Truman Capote when he was researching In Cold Blood?
Well, I think she had a lot of finesse in the way that she approached the residents of the town, particularly the women. And she was able to sort of subtly draw them out in a way that Capote initially maybe couldn't have done. So, and she was also his stenographer. Keep in mind that Capote never jotted down a single note or used a tape recorder when he interviewed all these people in Kansas. And it was up to... And now he claims that he had a, what is it?
A photographic memory.
Photographic memory, correct. But in fact, she was dutifully scribbling away many times.
Many times, but not all the time.
Many times, but not all the time, correct.
Capote described In Cold Blood as a nonfiction novel. What impact do you think the book had on nonfiction that was published after Capote's?
The way he structured the piece, the way he wrote various scenes, the way he used dialogue, it reads like a novel. So I think writers that came after Capote, now this In Cold Blood was published in the mid-60s, so he was working contemporaneously with a lot of these writers, but I think a lot of writers were influenced by this narrative skill and the way in which Capote brought a sort of rather prosaic murder story to life using his skills as a novelist. And so I think that was very influential.
I want to move on to another journalist who you write about in your book on new journalism, and that's Joan Didion. And she has a wonderful book on the bestseller list. That's a memoir about a year of grieving after her husband, the writer John Gregory Dunne, died of a sudden heart attack. It's an amazing book. I mean, she seems to stand back from her own grief as she's experienced it to just kind of record it as accurately and in as much detail as she can. How would you describe her place in the new journalism?
I think her influence is twofold because she was great at two things. Early on in her career, when she was freelancing for magazines like the Saturday Evening Post, she was doing a lot of straight reporting pieces, and they were quite good. And her eye for detail was novelistic. Her ability to capture the essence of her characters with a few deft strokes was uncanny. And she was a very good reporter, and she did these pieces. Now, the other thing she did, of course, were these personal essays, which are very sort of self-searching, extremely sensitive essays about her life and her psyche. And those arguably were even more influential, not in terms of new journalism, just in terms of people writing about themselves, the personal essay form. But she does have this ability to examine herself and her emotional makeup in a way that I don't think any other writer even does.
What are some of the ways that you think the new journalism, the novelistic approach to writing about actual events, affected newspapers and magazines and continues to affect what we're reading today in newspapers and magazines?
Well, it might have had a pernicious influence, I'm afraid, because Hunter Thompson, who was writing for Rolling Stone in the 70s, became such a rock star by placing himself in his own stories. And this led to a lot of really bad Hunter imitations. And when people thrust themselves into their own nonfiction narratives. And so, you know, there's been a lot of bad first-person writing that has been done in the wake of Hunter's stuff. But newspapers, I don't see it too much. I see it more in magazines like The Believer. Are you familiar with mm-hmm. Dave Eggers? Yeah. I think they do some really amazing narrative nonfiction pieces that are definitely new journalism-esque. And I still think The New Yorker does some great work like that, ironically enough, because at the start of my book, there is a story about Tom Wolfe basically attacking The New Yorker for being a horrible has-been magazine in 1965, sort of positioning himself and the fellow new journalists in opposition to what The New Yorker was all about. But, of course, The New Yorker still continues to put out great stuff. But I guess you might see it more on the web, although I'm not so impressed with what I read on the web, particularly the blogs, which I think are too hastily written. I think journalists need editors to really do the job right.
You know, I read a lot of nonfiction books, in part because I host this program.
And right.
One of the things, you know, one of the things I sometimes have a problem with in a lot of nonfiction books now is the amount of dialogue. Dialogue in scenes where I know the writer wasn't there, and the writer often says in the introduction that this is dialogue that was reported to him, you know, from by the interviewees who said, here's what I said and here's what was said to me. But it often, not always, but it often reads like a kind of fake recreation of something. And it sometimes makes me a little distrustful, because I figure, well, you can't really say word for word in quotes what somebody said 20 years ago in this room right. That you weren't in. Do you think that that's something that's happening a lot more since the new journalism
yes.
era?
Yes, no question. I mean, it was definitely endemic to new journalists, particularly people like Jimmy Breslin, who used a lot of made-up dialogue with impunity. But I think that writers do it out of fear more than anything else. I don't think they're trying to pull the wool over anyone's eyes. I think they're afraid that their story is going to be dull mm-hmm. if they don't use dialogue. And so they resort to inserting, you know, I don't think it's a hoax they're perpetrating. I just think they're afraid that people are going to turn off. Yeah, I think that's definitely a legacy of these guys that I write about in my book. But I think one can be judicious about it. And if one doesn't get too fanciful, I think it's okay. But if it's a situation where you're really heavily using so much dialogue that you didn't hear, that it just becomes absurd, well, then that's just no good.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much, Terry.
Mark Weingarten is the author of the new book, The Gang That Wouldn't Write Straight.